That's good news. Wonderful.
Okay, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratvold, Judge Cochran, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Diane B. Bratvold presiding.
Good morning. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and as the marshal indicated, today's date is July 8th, 2020. I welcome everyone to today's WebEx arguments. I understand we've had a few bumps in the road already to start things out, but it seems like we've corrected and are ready to move forward. So I just want to make sure initially that council are in fact able to hear and see the court, right? Yes. And what I'm saying, excellent. And then you also should have in front of you the clock that the marshal will be using. And you're familiar, I know, with our rules and procedures. So I'll just remind you of a couple of things before we begin the argument. First of all, when you begin your remarks to the court, please state your name as well as the party that you represent so that our record is clear. Secondly, remember to mute the mic when you are not speaking. So really when you're listening to the other argument as opposed to during your argument. And you'll note the judges are doing the same things. It just improves the quality of sound for us. And of course, we do use the recordings as well. But right now, we just want to be able to make sure we hear from you. So with that, we're ready to listen to your arguments today. I don't think I remembered to have the marshal call the first case, did I? I don't think so. We have three matters on our calendar. I'll call the first one. Lawyers are here. So 9:30 a.m. It was set. We're beginning just a little bit late. The file number is A19-2057. It's Jason Charles. I think it's Cebulka. Am I correct, counsel?
Cebulka.
Cebulka? Okay. As appellant petitioner versus the state of Minnesota respondent. And so with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of appellant Jason Cebulka. The issue before this court in this case really is whether Mr. Cebulka's unconstitutional conviction can stand. And that really boils down to, is my client different because he tried to challenge this issue many years ago? Now, to remind you of the very lengthy procedural posture in this case, Mr. Cebulka was convicted of test refusal for refusing a blood and urine test in October of 2012. Then after the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in McNeely in 2013, that's the first time Mr. Cebulka petitioned the district court to vacate his conviction. At that time, Mr. Cebulka argued that the Missouri v. McNeely decision made the test refusal statute unconstitutional as applied to his refusal of a warrantless blood or urine test, and that the rule of law announced in McNeely should be applied retroactively because it was a substantive rule of law. Now, since the parties have briefed this case, the Hagerman opinion has come out, which has held, of course, that the rule announced in Missouri v. McNeely is retroactive and does apply on collateral review to test refusal convictions for refusing a blood or urine test. That is the exact issue that was raised in the first post-conviction petition, and that is the exact issue that's before the court today. Now, after raising and being denied post-conviction relief in 2013, Mr. Cebulka appealed to this court and again argued the retroactivity of McNeely and argued that the McNeely decision meant that Minnesota's test refusal statute was unconstitutional. Like the district court, this court initially did not address whether McNeely made the test refusal statute unconstitutional, but simply held that it was not retroactive and thus did not apply to Mr. Cebulka. Now again, we know that that's no longer the case. And then after Mr. Cebulka lost at the Court of Appeals in 2015, he petitioned for review, that was denied. And then subsequently in 2016, the Birchfield, Thompson, and Trahan progeny of cases came out, which of course is known as now the Birchfield Rule. And then in 2018, the Birchfield Rule was held by the Court of Appeals in Johnson to be a procedural rule, thus not retroactively applicable. So Mr. Cebulka still at that point had nothing that was ripe for review based on the opinions from this court. Now in August of 2018, That's when the Minnesota Supreme Court reversed in Johnson and held that the rule announced is substantive and does apply retroactively to cases on collateral review. Now, after that decision was issued on June 5th, 2019, Mr. Cebulka then filed his second post-conviction petition based on, of course, the change in the law.
So, counsel, I appreciate that you've laid out these dates and timelines for us, and your brief is very clear in that regard as well. Before you, you know, as you noted, and I assumed you would take that position, Hagerman appears to control, from your perspective, and we'll hear from opposing counsel, the primary issue that is raised in your brief, so retroactivity of McNeely. And so it seems to me that I want to make sure you have enough time to discuss the timeliness of this petition. And then, of course, there were other challenges raised as well, waiver, law of the case, and I'm happy to hear all of those, but I think I understand your position on them. And instead, I'd love to have you turn to the 2-year statute of limitation for post-conviction petitions and specifically address, I mean, you make the assertion in your brief that the right timing for that is 2 years after the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson. And I'm just trying to understand your legal analysis because I don't see that fully briefed on either side. And of course, we don't have a lot of case law on when, how to trigger that exception. You know, when is it triggered and how do we work that particular exception? So, and it seems to me that's right in front of this court. So I need to hear your thinking on it.
Well, again, Your Honor, there is a bit of a twist in this case because it has been raised within 2 years of the conviction and sentencing date initially. The rule of law that is continuing to be litigated today was raised by Mr. Cebulka when he filed his initial petition back in 2013. And additionally, his subsequent post-conviction petition, the state argued that it was barred by the 2-year statute of limitations, and that argument was rejected by the district court. The district court did not address the 2-year time bar. It did not deny the petition based on the 2-year time bar. It simply ignored that assertion by the state and addressed the merits of the petition, holding that while Birchfield applied retroactively, McNeely did not. And that's what we're here appealing today, is the district court's determination that while the Birchfield rule applied retroactively, the McNeely rule did not. This post-conviction petition was not denied based on the 2-year time bar.
I understand that, counsel, but it is in front of this court. It has been properly raised again by the state. So I need to hear your analysis on why it should start with the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Johnson, or you seem to be implying that perhaps there's a special exception for Mr. Young because of his first post-conviction petition. Either way, I just need to hear your analysis.
Yes, Your Honor, Mr. Cebulka, yes. The 2-year statute of limitations in the post-conviction statute does have an exception under 4B3. So even if this court finds that Mr. Cebulka should have raised this decision within 2 years of the Birchfield decision, under 590.01.43b, under that subdivision, when a new rule of law or a new interpretation of federal or state constitutional law comes out, then that is the first day of the 2-year time bar. And the new interpretation of constitutional law here was the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Johnson. Before the Minnesota Supreme Court decided Johnson, the issue here was not ripe for Mr. Cebulka to have review, because the controlling precedent before the Supreme Court decided Johnson was this court's opinion in Johnson, holding that Birchfield was not retroactively applicable to Mr. Cebulka. So he did file it within 2 years of the new interpretation finding that Birchfield was retroactive. And of course, now we have the Hagerman decision finding that Birchfield and McNeely as interpreted through Birchfield are retroactive. And of course, that decision just came out in June. So we are within 2 years of that date. So by filing
So, counsel, it's not a case that was cited by either parties, but perhaps it's familiar to you. If not, you know, just let me know that. But the Minnesota Supreme Court, in a slightly different view, but was looking at the 2-year statute of limitations on post-conviction petitions, said that when it comes to asserting these exceptions that the claim would arise when the claimant, so here Mr. Young, knew or should have known that his claim existed. So it seems to me you're focused on when Mr. Young knew that he had a claim based on retroactivity. So in other words, the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Johnson. What about when Mr. Young should have known? Mr. Cebulka, I apologize. Mr. Cebulka should have known.
Well, again, when Mr. Cebulka knew and when Mr. Cebulka should have known are the same in this case.
Well, they're not though, because his first petition, as you said, he did argue retroactivity of McNeely. So he already showed that he knew it and should have known it. So I'm just looking for a working principle for how the court analyzes the 2-year statute of limitations in this context, because clearly he's demonstrated he knew and should have known way before the Minnesota Supreme Court issued its decision. And others would argue that he knew, and I think that's what we'll hear from the state, that he knew and should have known as of the McNeely decision or at the latest, the Birchfield decision. So if you'd respond to why that's the wrong analysis, it would help me immensely.
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Yes, Mr. Cebulka attempted to raise this interpretation of McNeely after the McNeely decision. But this court, in Mr. Cebulka's first appeal, stated that the rule of law Mr. Cebulka was attempting to establish did not exist. It was not the interpretation of McNeely. And if you look at the opinion on page 7, it says the rule that Cebulka seeks to establish in asserting this constitutional challenge to the test refusal statute might be a substantive rule if it is ultimately adopted, but it would necessarily depend on procedural principles. So at the time he raised this issue, this court told Mr. Cebulka that rule was not adopted, it did not exist. So he should not have known that he could challenge it under McNeely because he was rejected at the time of his first appeal. And then after the Birchfield opinion came out, this court in Johnson held that it was not retroactive. So just as Mr. Cebulka's initial claim in McNeely was rejected, once his interpretation of McNeely was vindicated and held to be true that McNeely means our test refusal statute is unconstitutional, then Johnson came out and held that that rule of law is not retroactive. So he would not have known, nor should he have known, at that time he would have a claim, because the claim that he was asserting was it should be retroactively applied. And until the Supreme Court reversed in Johnson and held Birchfield retroactive, there was no issue for Mr. Cebulka to raise with the post-conviction court because he had been rejected the first time. And then the precedent that came after, until the Supreme Court's opinion in Johnson, rejected the retroactivity argument. So it was not ripe. It was not an issue he could have or should have known he could raise until the Minnesota Supreme Court's opinion in Johnson. And
Ms.
that
Lockwood,
is when the 2-year time bar should start.
I'm going to follow up a bit from Judge Bradfield's question, because I believe the majority of the cases we've had where the same analysis is considered and the same precedent is the immigration effect on individual defendants. And I'm trying to distinguish what you just described in his should have known based on our court's earlier decision from those same arguments, or at least they seem same, for those who learn of their immigration impact of their plea of guilty after the 2 years, and the court squarely seems to have indicated, the Supreme Court has, that again, the trigger would have been at the time of the plea. And so how would you distinguish those cases using that same Supreme Court analysis of 590 and those exceptional timelines to this scenario?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Cebulka is not claiming that the 2-year time bar should start from when he learned of the issue in his case. He is claiming that under 4B3, the 2-year time bar should start from when the Minnesota Supreme Court's opinion in Johnson stated that the rule of law in Birchfield is retroactive. And that is what Mr. Cebulka argued within 2 years of his conviction and sentencing initially, and was rejected. So he raised it within the 2-year time bar, was told that's not the rule of law in McNeely, that's not what McNeely says, and even if it is, McNeely's not retroactive. He could not have raised that issue until the Minnesota Supreme Court in Johnson issued its decision finding the Birchfield rule retroactive. And that's when the two-year time bar starts. It's not related to whether or when Mr. Cebulka learned of an issue. It's related to when the change in the law came about. And that is exactly what 4B3 states, is that a new interpretation of federal or state constitutional statutory law by either the United States or a Minnesota appellate court is when that two-year time bar starts. And that occurred when the Minnesota Supreme Court issued its decision in Johnson, finding the Birchfield rule retroactive. That is when the issue became ripe for Mr. Cebulka to raise again in his post-conviction petition. Before that, it was not an issue that he should have or even could have raised at the time. He would have been barred from raising the issue as a subsequent challenge to his conviction that had already been addressed. The case law was continuing to say it's not retroactive, and that's what he was told the first time he raised the issue. And so until Johnson came out and said this rule of law is retroactive, the two-year time bar did not start for Mr. Cebulka or for any person convicted of test refusal in Minnesota who wanted to collaterally attack their conviction and retroactively apply the rule of law announced in Birchfield interpreting McNeely. Mr. Cebulka is essentially Birchfield.
Counsel, you don't have much time left, but could you briefly address the waiver issue raised by respondent and respondent's argument that appellant didn't raise McNeely in the most recent post-conviction petition?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Cebulka did raise the issue of McNeely's interpretation through Birchfield. And of course, in the Hagerman case, specifically the court says, I see my time's about to run. May I finish, Your Honor? It specifically says, we conclude the rule of law announced in McNeely is substantive in the context of test refusal cases challenged under Birchfield. That is exactly here. This is the rule of law in McNeely, retroactively applicable to this case where the test refusal was challenged under Birchfield. That's exactly the analysis of the district court here, finding Birchfield was retroactive, but McNeely was not. And as such, we ask this court to correct that error.
Thank you, counsel. And of course, if you choose to expand on that, you can do so in your rebuttal time. So with that, I think the clock has been reset, and counsel for respondent, we are ready to listen. Thank you.
Honor and good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. The state is asking this court to affirm the denial of post-conviction relief because the claims are procedurally barred that are made on appeal here. But I'll start briefly with the Hagerman question just to get to clear that up. The state's position is, though, that it does respectfully disagree with this court's decision in Hagerman that it is indeed controlling as to the question of whether McNeely is retroactively applicable. But it isn't dispositive in terms of the outcome of this case, in the sense that there's this procedural bars that I want to address. And I do want to concentrate as well on this two-year statute of limitations issue. As I perceive that issue, there are two distinct issues raised both by the court's questioning today and the briefing with regard to the statute of limitations and whether the appellant's claim can fall within the exception that he asserts. Those are, first of all, the question that's been discussed today, when does a claim accrue in terms of a new interpretation of law? And then secondly, the pleading issue that I discussed at some length in my brief in terms of whether the pleadings were sufficient here to raise this exception in the first place. And if the court finds in either way that the appellant has failed to establish that a new interpretation of federal or state constitutional or statutory law applies, The claim is time barred, and that should end the analysis there. With regard to the questioning of counsel about the when does a claim sort of begin to accrue with a new interpretation of federal law, the state's position would be that it would be, in this case, when Birchfield was announced. And the reason for that is the new rule under Well, let me back up. The post-conviction statute allows for claims based on new interpretations of federal or state constitutional or statutory law. And my understanding of a retroactivity analysis is that it is neither statutory nor constitutional law. I think the Danforth decision from the U.S. Supreme Court would probably make that pretty clear, in the sense that it leaves it up to the states to decide what standard to adopt for retroactivity. So it would seem then that it can't be certainly a federal constitutional issue, because if it was, all states would be required to have as a minimum the Teague v. Lane analysis for retroactivity. So it would seem
that you certainly make a good point about the retroactivity analysis, but it seems to me the exception has already directed that we will consider retroactivity as part of that exception to the two-year statute of limitations. It's in the language itself.
Okay. Well, and the other thing I wanted to point out about that is, certainly if Mr. Johnson in the Johnson case had not raised his claims within 2 years of Birchfield, I think everyone would probably agree they would be time barred. And so it would then seem to follow that anyone would also have to make their claims within 2 years of Birchfield. So for those reasons, to answer the court's questions to opposing counsel, it would seem that the 2 years would start to run when Birchfield is announced. Mr. Johnson, although there was no rule at the time indicating that the 2 years, or I'm sorry, that there was no rule of retroactivity when Birchfield was announced, made his claim within 2 years. And in fact, I would note that, as I recall, one of Mr. Johnson's convictions was pre-McNeely, I believe 2010 or 2011, around the same time as this case occurred. So he had a pre-McNeely case too. So I don't think that the pre-McNeely nature of this case should make a difference with regard to that issue.
And I didn't hear appellant's counsel as arguing that, so maybe I missed her point in that regard. I would like you to address appellant's contention that, given that Mr. Sobolka raised in his first petition the retroactivity analysis, that was rejected by the district court, by this court, the review was denied by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and he needed an intervening change in the law before he could refile a second post-conviction petition and assert what he is now asserting, retroactivity of McNeely. So would you address that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I would note that, first of all, the appellant is arguing here that the appellants, this kind of gets into the second part of my argument about the statute of limitations, is that the actual post-conviction petition did not even argue that McNeely was retroactive. It seemed to assume that, and in fact, I believe one of the issues or arguments in appellant's brief to this court was that Birchfield explicitly made made McNeely retroactive by its very terms. I could be wrong on that, but I believe that was in the brief, and I know it was also addressed in the Hagerman opinion and rejected. But if I'm right about my recollection of the appellant's brief in this case, it would seem that appellant is trying to have it both ways by saying, well, this is explicit in Birchfield. It's very clear by Birchfield's own terms that McNeely is retroactive, but then not raising it within 2 years of that would seem problematic. But again, I could be misremembering counsel's brief on that specific issue, so I apologize if I'm misrepresenting it. It's not intentional. But then my second response to that is that this gets to the pleading issue again, that there was no pleading in the second post-conviction petition saying that McNeely was retroactive. And that kind of segues into that issue, is that the statute, in terms of the exception to the post-conviction 2-year statute of limitations, is pretty clear that the petitioner in the post-conviction proceeding has the burden of showing that there is a new rule of federal or state law, and secondly, has to establish that that rule of law applies to the petitioner's case specifically. And I know the Fagan case that was cited in the briefs, although that's dealing with a somewhat different issue, points that out as well, that that particular time bar supports the general proposition that it's the petitioner's burden. And here, the petitioner simply failed to do that. The appellant failed to make any argument to the post-conviction court that McNeely was retroactive. And therefore, the claim was simply time barred as a matter of law because they failed to establish, and it's their burden to establish that McNeely is, or in this case, McNeely would be the rule that they want retroactively applied to them, would in fact retroactively applied. They argued Birchfield was retroactively applicable, but that doesn't get them any relief in this case because they'd have to show that not only is Birchfield retroactive, but so is McNeely.
So counsel, you're weaving together your waiver argument with the post-conviction timeliness of the post-conviction petition. I'm just trying to make sure I understand your position.
Right. So thank you for asking that clarification question, because I do want to differentiate between the two, but the facts that support them overlap. So the waiver argument is based on the fact that the appellant, again, just didn't raise this issue to the post-conviction court, period. That same fact, the failure to raise the issue, also makes the claim time barred because it is the burden of a post-conviction petitioner to establish, to get first petition filed after 2 years after the conviction is final, that the new rule of law applies to the petitioner's case. So it's that same fact really applies to both of those procedural bars, and is what really animates both of them, but they are distinct.
So counsel, I don't think you're directly addressing what I hear as appellant's argument, because their position is that the 2 year exception would be triggered as of the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson. And that is, I believe, pretty consistently argued and analyzed by them. On the other hand, the references to McNeely and the focus on McNeely in large measure, so now I'm shifting over to your waiver argument, in large measure turn on the district court's analysis of the second post-conviction petition. Because while the appellant argued an expansive Birchfield rule, you know, Mr. Sobolka argued that in his second petition, the district court very specifically, you know, stuck with Johnson and found the Birchfield rule retroactive, but then held McNeely was not. So that, to me, suggests that that is the adverse determination that they are raising on appeal and is traditionally viewed as within our scope of review. So go right ahead and tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, so this raises kind of an interesting legal question, I think, in terms of what waiver, we call it waiver, although maybe it's better term forfeiture, but the decisions call it waiver, what that means in this context, because what we have in this situation is where essentially the appellant in the post-conviction petition sort of pled half of what needed to be pleaded. They pleaded Birchfield, which was a sufficient but not necessary condition for relief, but they did not plead McNeely, which was the second half of the necessary part of the pleading in order to get relief. And so that puts us in a situation where the district court has to, if it's going to address the claim on the merits, and obviously I advocated that it didn't need to, but that's what it chose to do. So it addresses the claim on the merits, and in order to fully do that, it has to address the argument that wasn't actually pled, because otherwise it can't fully address the claim on the merits. And so that's why I termed this sort of a pleading issue earlier in my argument, because it raises the question of, if a district court is going to do a full analysis of a claim that was only half pled, does that excuse the half pleading on appeal? The state's position would be that it should not. And I think that argument would apply to both the statute of limitations issue and the waiver issue. And what I would note too, just backing up a little bit with regard to generally speaking, the post-conviction law, is that we to kind of apply the baseball terminology in a normal criminal case, while the case is pending before it's final, we might say the tie should go to the defendant. But in the post-conviction context, I think it's the opposite, that if there is a close call, essentially, or a tie, it goes in front to the state, because these are convictions that are presumptively valid under the case law.
Counsel, do you have any case law you can cite to support your position that this court shouldn't consider the McNeely issue, given that the district court considered it or analyzed it in its decision?
I don't have anything specifically on that. I like I said, I think it raises sort of a novel issue of pleading versus a district court's full analysis of an issue that maybe wasn't fully pled out in the document. So I don't have any specific cases I can cite. What I can cite more generally is the Azure, A-Z-U-R-E case I cited in my brief with regard to waiver. That doesn't specifically address your question, Judge Cochran, but what it does address is just generally speaking, when we have claims that are sort of similar raised in a post-conviction petition to claim raised on appeal, a claim that comes out of the same constitutional provision as the one raised on appeal and is even related analytically. That was an ineffective assistance of trial counsel raised in a post-conviction petition, and then they added an effective assistance of appellate counsel on appeal, and the court said, no, that wasn't raised at the district court, it's waived. Now, again, that's not directly answering your question, Your Honor, and I acknowledge that, but I do think it's the best case that I found in a post-conviction setting that deals with this situation.
Thank you. I have another question for you. Hypothetically, if appellant had filed a similar petition within 2 years of Birchfield and raised the retroactivity of both Birchfield and McNeely, in your view, would that be within the two-year time frame permitted in the exception for a new constitutional or the subdivision 4A3?
I think it would have to be under these circumstances, at least if we take as a given that Birchfield is retroactively applicable because it's substantive. I think the answer has to be yes, especially given the fact that this court held that the McNeely rule wasn't retroactive. I think the answer would be yes in that situation. I can't really think of a good argument that the answer would be no off the top of my head.
And in this case, your argument is that it's untimely because it's more than 2 years after Birchfield?
That's part of the argument based on the questioning that was raised today. But the argument that I really stressed in my brief was as a matter of pleading that the appellant simply failed to establish to get in the door under the statute of limitations that this new rule of law, whatever we might term the new rule of law to be, was applicable to the petitioner's case by not arguing that McNeely was retroactively applicable to begin with by just relying on Birchfield and making a general Birchfield argument.
By not specifically arguing McNeely.
Correct, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. And my time has expired, and I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. So in just a moment, I think we'll have our clock reset for the rebuttal time. And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to return this court's attention to the opinion in Hagerman, and specifically quoting the decision that states the rule of law announced in McNeely is substantive in the context of test refusal cases challenged under Birchfield. That is the rule of law announced in Hagerman, and that is this case. Mr. Cebulka, in the petition, challenged his test refusal under Birchfield. And the rule of law in Hagerman states that if you challenge your test refusal conviction under Birchfield, that McNeely retroactively applies. Now, the state is asserting two separate arguments regarding whether the issue here can't be reviewed by this court. The first one of them is that he failed to raise McNeely below. Well, I've just addressed that. He raised the interpretation of McNeely through Birchfield. And of course, he raised the interpretation of McNeely the first time he addressed the issue with his first post-conviction petition, but was rejected and told that's not the rule of law in McNeely. And the second thing that the court raises is if petitioner did raise the issue of McNeely, then he would have been barred from consideration because of the law of the case. The law of the case doctrine stating that because McNeely was held not to be retroactive the first time around, then McNeely must continue to be not retroactive in Mr. Sobolka's case. Now, that just they both simply can't be true. Either he sufficiently raised the issue of the retroactivity of McNeely through raising Birchfield, or he raised the issue of McNeely by simply raising it. It can't be rejected as the law of the case and also not be raised. So either way, the state is asserting that Mr. Sobolka shouldn't be able to have this issue reviewed by this court. But both the arguments asserted by the state just are not supported by law or the facts of this case. He did sufficiently raise the issue of the retroactivity of McNeely by challenging his test refusal conviction under Birchfield. And that's exactly what the Hagerman opinion states. And that is controlling precedent over this case. I see there's no—
So counsel, I'll just ask you one quick question and follow up. One of the arguments that state's counsel made is that Mr. Sobolka should be viewed in the same position as Mr. Johnson. So Mr. Johnson raised his challenge, obviously prior to the Supreme Court's decision, and therefore Mr. Sobolka should have also been held to that same 2-year limit under Birchfield. So would you go ahead and analyze that?
Yes, Your Honor. So Mr. Sobolka is different than Mr. Johnson because Mr. Sobolka raised the interpretation of McNeely before Mr. Johnson and was rejected, and told that McNeely did not retroactively apply to his case. So until there was a decision that applied the case law retroactively, he couldn't have raised it again, otherwise he would have been NAFLA barred, as opposed to Mr. Johnson, who was raising it for the first time after Birchfield. And then before Mr. Sobolka raised the issue, this court issued their decision in Johnson, which reaffirmed Mr. Sobolka's Court of Appeals opinion stating that McNeely did not retroactively apply and thus neither did Birchfield. So Mr. Sobolka had no remedy, no ability to obtain relief at that time because he'd already raised the issue and it had been rejected in his case. So he needed to wait until there was a new interpretation of law that went against the decision in his case. Otherwise, the law of the case doctrine might apply to his case because it was not retroactively applicable until the Supreme Court decided Johnson. If there are no further questions.
I have a quick follow-up, and maybe I'm missing something, but why didn't Birchfield itself provide a new constitutional interpretation that would have allowed Mr. Sobolka to file a new post-conviction petition and raise McNeely again based on the same argument that was made in Hagerman?
Because Birchfield was the interpretation of law from McNeely that Mr. Sobolka had attempted to raise the first time around, which was rejected, and then it was held to be not retroactive. So he didn't have the ability to raise that issue. Within 2 years of Birchfield, the Court of Appeals Johnson opinion held it not retroactive.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anything further by either panel member? Okay. All right. Thank you so much, both lawyers. We very much appreciate the arguments that you've presented today. This matter is obviously complicated and we've already experienced some changes in the law with the Hagerman coming down after your briefing. So with that, the matter is submitted to this court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe.